Do spirits exist, and if so, can they play an essential role in our individual and collective lives? A question that Dr. Gary Schwartz continues to chase. Great research. We're going to talk about his work, The Sacred Promise, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Gary Schwartz, PhD, professor of psychology, medicine, neurology, psychiatry, and surgery at the University of Arizona, also director of its Laboratory for Advances in Consciousness and Health. His research integrates mind-body medicine, energy medicine, and spiritual medicine as well. Accomplished author, in addition to his many works. And here he is, Dr. Gary Schwartz, back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Gary, how are you?
Wonderful, thanks. And how are you?
Good. Looking forward to this. It's been,
me too.
Been a couple of years for you, hasn't it, on the program?
It has been a couple of years. And you know, one of the things that's so wonderful about your show, as you know, you're one of the few that actually take a significant amount of time to talk about exciting, you know, areas of work and opportunity and challenge and so on.
Well, you know, I think in-depth is so important. You know, people really want to digest a subject, whatever it is.
Right.
And, you know, you just can't do it justice in a half hour or so.
Exactly. You know, what's really special, I just have to acknowledge this right in the beginning, is that today was the official day that the Sacred Promise book was being published. And coincidentally, it just so happened that it worked out that on the day that it was being born, so to speak, was the day that the night that I got to appear with you on this show. So the first generally public discussion about this is probably going to be the most in-depth conversation about it.
And it's a 1-11-11.
And it's a 1-11-11. Isn't that wonderful?
I like that. Gary, tell to the many new listeners who've joined us since you were last on 2008, tell us a little bit more about yourself other than the bio. I mean, how did you get interested in investigating science with the spirit world? What were the issues that got you that far?
Well, that's a great question. How far back do we go? I mean, in some
respects, you go back to the little boy of Gary Schwartz.
The little boy of Gary Schwartz. I had a feeling you were going to say that. Well, the little boy of Gary Schwartz was actually fascinated by two things. He was fascinated by science. And I had multiple laboratories in my basement and nature, and I used to collect all kinds of animals and read the Book of Knowledge and so on. And there was my, you know, science and engineering side. And then I was also a musician. I played actually. By the time I was 12, I had played 12 different instruments because I grew up in a musical household. I had a natural talent. When I was 13, I picked up the electric guitar. And that was just when the era when rock and roll was beginning, and I was ready, so to speak, fairly accomplished. And so I immediately started even playing professionally in a rock and roll band. It actually became quite a big one on Long Island at the time. And, of course, electric guitar is a funny kind of instrument because it's bridging science, electronics, sound, vibration, energy, of course, with music, with, you know, with the mind and with human performance. So, but I would have to say that there was nothing consciously spiritual about me at all. I mean, I grew up in basically in what I affectionately refer to as an Orthodox agnostic home, you know, sort of a Reformed Jewish home.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by Orthodox agnostic was that it didn't matter what the question was, you know, is there gravity or is there God? Sort of the philosophy, particularly my father, sort of inspired me was the idea that the approach was that my response was, I don't know, could be yes, could be no, show me the data, I'm open. On the other hand, my parents believed that it was ashes to ashes, dust to dust, case closed. I mean, there was nothing about like survival of consciousness after death. The idea of angels, well, they were in the same category as Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. And then, of course, I went off to undergraduate school and then eventually graduate school at Harvard. And there, the culture was very, you know, atheistic, very materialistic.
Sure. Yeah.
And so by that time, I was pushed really far away from the possibility of a greater spiritual reality. And it's kind of amusing, I mean, and kind of wondrous about how I was sort of led to do this kind of work. And I ultimately came to the conclusion that it was circumstances that itself involved the greater spiritual reality.
When you were last on with me, I think we were talking about your latest work at the time, the GOD, the God Experiments, I think. Wasn't that it?
I can't remember whether it was the God experiments or the energy healing experiments, actually. Okay. It was one or the other.
This one, The Sacred Promise, what's this one about?
This one is by far the most, I think, important, challenging, visionary, controversial, fun, significant books that I've ever had the privilege to write. Because this is a book that I didn't plan to write, that I had great trepidations about publishing, because it addresses these two fundamental questions. One, is spirit real? Is there a greater spiritual reality? How would we know? How could science actually take us to this question? But the second thing, the more important one, is the question of if a spiritual reality exists, can and does spirit play a role in our individual and collective lives? And is that the critical step that we have to come to acknowledge if we're ultimately going to not only have a more complete sense of what reality really is, i.e. the new paradigm, but also that's going to be what's going to be critical for helping to solve the major problems that we face as a species and our planet? Because in part, we're living in an incomplete world, and we can't do it alone. We may really need the assistance of a greater spiritual reality. That's why the subtitle, How Science is Discovering Spirit's Collaboration with Us in Our Daily Lives, is a very bold statement.
This obvious involvement by spirit,
mm-hmm.
Why does that happen? I mean, do we summon it? Do we ask for the help? Or do they decide, let's help this person?
By the way, I know your listeners know this, but one of the great joys would be that having a conversation with you is you ask such great questions, okay? That's a wonderful question.
That's because we have great guests who can give me the answers.
No, it's definitely a two-way street, let me tell you. Okay. I mean, I think it's nice that I'm part of the loop. Anyway, getting back to your question. The conclusion that I've come to, and I've come to this by evidence, some of which we'll talk about tonight. I've come to it partly by sheer logic, reasoning, and I've also come to it by direct personal experience, which in my own life I approach as a scientist. And the conclusion is basically as follows, and that is that, quote, spirit, the broad meaning of spirit, which is mostly things that we can't, quote, see with our mm-hmm. conventional senses, and is very much essentially akin to energy and information. A sidebar for the second. You know, with our eyes, for example, which are brilliant, and we see all the millions of colors and all the complexity and beauty that we see, which fills our consciousness, the truth is that what our eyes see is only an absolute minuscule spectrum of all the frequencies that are actually present in the universe. And in fact, I use the example that if we imagine the full spectrum of photons that exist in a room right now, and we imagine that to be the size of the Empire State Building, and then we ask what percentage of those frequencies we actually can see with our eyes, it turns out the size that we see relative to the Empire State Building, over 100 stories high, is around the size of a grain of sand or the thickness of the paint on the wall. So most of it's invisible. Now, all of that invisible energy, and by extension, invisible spirit, which is all there,
sure.
It's still present. And so another metaphor that I've used is I say that, what if spirit is like air or water, meaning that it's always around us, it's essential for our very existence. We're, without thinking about it, breathing it in, breathing it out. And just like air or water, even though it's there all the time and we're getting assistance all the time, the truth is, just like we can learn to breathing exercise, for example, and learn how to meditate and learn how to breathe to play an instrument or to be in a sport, we can learn to invite spirit in. We can learn to attract the right kind of spirit and therefore enhance our conscious awareness of an involvement with this greater spiritual or energetic reality.
Was the spirit world, Gary, always there in tandem with the physical?
Wow, what a great question. Now, let me approach this by going about the way we were typically educated to believe this. I'm talking about in Western science versus where we where that science is now leading us. If you would, the old idea, the conventional idea, was that basically we live in a physical world, a material world, and that's what's primary. And that even our consciousness is actually a byproduct. It's a, if you would, an invention or a side effect of the physical world. So the physical world comes first, and then, if you would, energy and information and mind come later. That's what's called the materialist perspective. But now what's happening is, of course, a little over 100 years ago with Einstein and E equals mc squared, we began to understand that matter was really energy, and energy was really matter. So one could be converted into the other. And therefore, what we call matter is really, quote, organized energy. And, of course, we now know matter is mostly empty space. Then, however, the big step was the realization that actually what's primary is energy. And what we and energy is created by matter. And what matter is actually a special state, a crystallized, if you would, or more stabilized energy. So in this, from this perspective, if energy is primary and matter is a special case of energy, and of course what we mean by spirit is what we also mean by energy, and is then we come to the conclusion that spirit was always here first, and matter is actually a ultimately a product of spirit or a product of energy. One last point, food for thought. And that is, the materialist perspective is essentially that material creates intention, mm-hmm. because material creates consciousness. But this post-materialist perspective, as Dr. Lisa Miller, who's a professor at Columbia, calls it, this post-materialist perspective, in that perspective, actually, it's back. We have it backwards. It's actually intention that comes first, and intention creates matter. So just like, you know, we used to think that the sun revolved around the earth, and it was obvious, and everybody believed that, and it turned out it was wrong. We had it backwards.
Yeah.
Well,
way backwards.
Way backwards. Well, I think we've got this one way backwards, too. And that shift in thinking is as it's more transformative. It's more dramatic, a paradigm shift. It's more thinking about the world in an entirely new way than the paradigm shift of the Copernican Revolution.
When you were talking about the reasons why you believe the spirit world exists and mm-hmm. the evidence out there, does faith play a part in that, Gary?
Well, you know, well, again, thank you for asking such deep questions right up front. I trust that your audience appreciates that you're like this and that they want to hear these answers themselves.
I just hope I don't run out of them by the time our interview's up.
Well, you know, we always have the opportunity. First of all, you don't run out of them.
No,
and at this rate, we'll be going for a very long time. No, okay. Getting back to the faith question. It actually doesn't require faith at all. Faith is something that, from my perspective, I call it actually evidence-based faith. And let me explain what I mean by that, if I might.
Sure.
Because it's also the metaphor, I even have a chapter called The Gravity of Spirit that introduces this all. You know, I or you, we could take a pen, or in Newton's day it was an apple, and if we let it go and we're on the earth, it will fall to the ground. And every time I've done that experiment, I've done it thousands of times, the pen falls. And I do this for students in my class. And I'll tell them, I say, you know, whenever I lose faith in humanity or lose faith in nature, I begin to question things, I drop things. And every time I've done the experiment in my physical form, it's fallen. Now, I know that in space, you know, with the absence of what would be my gravitational force, or not really absence, but reduction, that it's not going to act that way. And I'm certainly open to the possibility that somebody with their mind could slow it down or even reverse it, and maybe it doesn't operate this in other parts of the universe. But all I know is that when I do the experiment, I let go of the pen, it falls. I can put my faith in that. I can put my trust in it, meaning faith, based on the evidence. You know, if I go to sleep at night, my mind may be in another universe. But I never have to worry that when I wake up in the morning, my body's going to be floating out the window.
Yeah.
My body is still in bed, my physical body. So in that sense, evidence takes us to faith. Now, that kind of faith is a science-based faith, as opposed to just we're told to take things on faith.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody in authority says,
Right.
This is the way it is, and this is what you need to do. Yeah. Now, so that's where the scientist says we should all be self-scientists, which is what I talk about in this book. We should all be practicing science applied to ourselves, because then we can make phenomenal discoveries that only we ourselves can make. Now, the last comment about this, about the faith side, is, which is wonderful about that we can have faith, is that the positive side of faith is that when we have insufficient evidence, faith is sort of what keeps us going.
That's what kicks in.
That's what kicks in. That's what keeps us going when we're in a question state. And since most of the time we are in a question state, very few things are 100% like gravity.
Well, that's true.
Then we have to act on inference. And so what I recommend is that we develop the new, if you would, science-based spirituality, is that we don't give up faith. In fact, we recognize the power of faith. But what we do is we do it mindfully. We do it discerningly. And we don't do it with a closed mind. We do it with an open mind.
I'm convinced that people with the faith are happier.
Yes. And you know what happens when they're really happy? Is when that faith is an evidence-based faith. So it's not just a faith that is that they're taking on faith.
Right.
But it's a faith that they have a reason to believe in. It's a faith that they've seen evidence for. In fact, one of the things that occurred to me after I wrote this book is that the Sacred Promise book is actually an evidence-based hope book. It provides evidence in the hope for all of this. And what that takes you to is increasing peace and gratitude and fascination and awe and trust and inspiration. It's in many respects a comforting philosophy, even though it also opens you to the possibility of that there's a negative side to all of this, too.
True. And we're going to get into that part,
sure,
too. You called it the Sacred Promise. What does that mean?
That's a very important question, because both the words sacred and promise are significant. And let's take the promise part first.
Okay.
The promise part, promise has two meanings. First of all, this promise as in potential. You know, we say this is a promising avenue to explore. The promise is in the looking toward the future. It has hope. It has promise. So one of the things that I talk about with one of the meanings of the sacred promise is essentially that science has the promise to actually prove that all this is more than real or discover that it's not. So it's not that science can't address these questions. Quite the contrary. What this book reveals is that science can address these questions. And not only that, when you look at all the evidence in total, the promise is that it's going to take us to a greater spiritual reality. But it's a promise. It's a prediction. It's a possibility. Mm-hmm. That's one meaning of promise. But the second meaning of the promise is really is equally important, and that's promise as in commitment. It's promise as in contract.
My word.
It's my word. So, for example, which is another meaning which I talk about in the book, if I'm going to show up in the laboratory and invite spirit, for example, to come into a chamber where I've got very sensitive equipment to detect their presence, they've got to promise to show up, meaning if I'm going to be there, they're going to be there. And if I don't know that there are certain individuals on the other side that have a commitment to showing up, even though it's a hypothesized commitment, if they're not going to make a commitment, a responsibility to be there, at least be as responsible as the us physical experiment is, I'm not going to waste my time.
Good point.
So there's that matter. Then there's the question of sacred. Now, sacred's a really interesting term. It's one, by the way, that I've never used before. In all of my years of writing, and before that as a kid, the word sacred was not in my vocabulary.
Gary, we're going to take this break, and I want to get back and talk about sacred in full, in detail, as we talk with Dr. Gary Schwartz, The Sacred Promise, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Fascinating discussion. Wait till you get into some of the stories behind The Sacred Promise. And we're with Dr. Gary Schwartz. Gary, we were talking about the sacred, that portion of your book. Go ahead.
Yes. You know, as a professional scientist for all these years, a word that, of course, doesn't come up in my vocabulary is sacred.
Hmm.
And one of the things I came to realize was that this promise this promise of both possibility and commitment from science and from the greater spiritual reality, because that was the conclusion that the book was coming to, that this promise was not just an individual promise. It was not just a collective promise. It was a, quote, sacred promise. And the word sacred has a couple of meanings here, because one of the implications of a sacred promise is the notion that it's serious, that this is a real commitment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a promise. Like, you know, people get married, and in the old days, people would say, till death do us part. But when they made that contract, I mean, today, anyone who says that, they really, that's not what a marriage license means.
No, it
just means we'll be together for as long as it's comfortable for us, and we like each other, and then it's okay, no fault divorce, we'll move on. So that promise is no longer a sacred promise. It's anything. It's an empty promise. So this was, first of all, it was very serious. It was sincere. But on top of that is the notion that some things can be so reverential, can be so fundamental, so core, so universal, so cherished, that they end up taking us to the idea of a great spirit, or a universal mind, or a Yahweh, or a God, or an Allah, or a source. You know, whatever words you wish to use for a oneness. The implications of this book, and I take people to this, but that's going to be really explored even in more and further books, is the notion that there really is this kind of sacred process going on, and we can discover it in our personal lives as scientists, not just in the laboratory of the university, but the laboratory of our personal lives.
And both are important, aren't they?
Yes. Each one are important, and together they're more powerful than either one alone. Then they both need each other.
The science of the laboratory, what are they doing to try to prove the existence of the other side?
Well, there are various kinds of research. One area, for example, which I do not talk about in the Sacred Promise, is work that's continuing on near-death experiences. And as you know, this is when people are close to death and their brains are literally, quote, dead, meaning that there's no EEG function and so on. And yet people are having conscious experiences of a very profound nature. And then they're brought back to life, for example, their hearts are restarted. And then they come back and they recount these experiences and they're transformed as a result. And this is very difficult to explain in any other way except that there's something going on that the mind doesn't require a brain to function, and there's much more in the universe than we're currently aware. So that's one area of research. Second area of research, which I talk about a fair amount in The Sacred Promise, is research on mediumship, on mediums who can connect with the other side. But in this book, what I talk about is that there are sort of professional mediums who do this kind of thing, and then there's also people in their own personal lives who start having these kinds of intuitive moments, and they have these experiences, and they're not, if you would, general mediums, because they can't read anybody, but for their own particular loved ones, they develop a special relationship.
And it works for them.
And it works for them, and we'll talk about that, some very dramatic stories. But the third example, the one which I'm most excited about, and which I reveal for the first time in this book, is that science is creating new technologies to make it possible to detect the tiniest amount of energy. So, for example, and again, we'll talk about this, there's a device called the silicon photomultiplier system, which detects single photons of light in utter pitch darkness, and you can track them precisely, which is utterly extraordinary.
Almost like night vision goggles, probably way better.
Oh, no. It's so far beyond night goggles. It is like night goggles, but to an extreme.
Right.
And I want
to
get to a metaphor of that in a second since you brought it up. So thank you. And using this kind of technology, with the latest solid-state physics and the latest in circuitry and the latest in computers, we can actually use this to not only detect the presence of spirit, that is, collaborating spirit from the other side, what we now call our sacred promise team. But also, these devices have the promise, and we'll get to that at some point about the soul phone, to be actually converted into technology. That we're having what I call a Wright Brothers moment in science again in these areas. So these are very exciting times. Now, talking about night goggles is beautiful. So if I could just share one thing. because this was a huge take-home lesson to me while I was a professor at Yale, and it's become really salient now. And it's perfect since your show is at night. You know, we look up at the sky at night, particularly if we're in a sky without a moon. There's no moon in the sky right now. It's cloudy. You know, there's no clouds. And we're away from the city, you know, like in the woods or near the ocean if you're away from the city.
Right.
And we can see thousands of stars with the naked eye. And with telescopes, of course, we can see billions of stars and billions of galaxies. And all that light is present in the, quote, vacuum of space. And it's outrageously complex. And it goes into our tiny little pupils, okay? It's very hard to fathom how all this can occur, but it does. Now, during the day, we look up in the sky, the same sky, and let's say there's no clouds, no moon, of course. We look up, and what we see is blue, not a single star. And the question is, what happened to all that starlight? Did it merely, quote, disappear, or is it all still there? It's just that we're blinded by the closest star in our vicinity, which, of course, is what we call the sun. So the take-home message, the soundbite, is sometimes you have to go into the dark in order to see the light. Sometimes you have to go into the dark in order to see the light. And that's what we're doing now with contemporary technology. And that's also what people do when they meditate, and when people go into trances. And when people get away from all the wondrous and crazy lives that we live with, filled with all of this external sensation, you know, light and sound and touch and taste and so on, we go into a super quiet state. It's like we're going into the darkness. And then we have the capability to see the more subtle information that's there all around us, but during the day we don't notice.
Gary, you had John Edward write your foreword.
That's correct.
He's, you know, one of our world-renowned mediums.
Right.
Was it difficult getting to him? Are you friends with him?
Well, John is a very busy. John's a very busy person. And we email each other, I don't know, maybe twice a year, just to say hello. Because John was one of the first mediums that I had the privilege to work with. And he was really devoted to research. And he was very public about his devotion to research. In fact, he participated in the first three major experiments that I did, which were published in the Afterlife Experiments book. And it was he and his guide, supposedly, because he called me from an airport. And he said, Gary, my guides are telling me that you've got to write a book. You've got to write it now. And in fact, I started writing the Afterlife Experiments book because John insisted upon it. I mean, I didn't do it just because he said it. But I did it because I knew that he was right, that the story needed to be told, the data were too important, they needed to be collected and put forth in a way that people could understand, and so on. So anyway, John played a very pivotal role. Now, we're not, quote, friends like family. We don't go out and play together. We haven't done anything professionally in a long time. But we still sort of stay in contact. And John knows the kind of person I am because he's followed the work over the years. He was with me from the beginning.
He obviously respects you.
Well, apparently, because you read the foreword, it's very laudatory and very compelling. So I'm really honored that he feels the way he does and said the way things that he does. But he can put it into a perspective of someone who's been on the front line, someone who's truly gifted. Someone who is an evidence-based medium, evidence-based psychic. He's a bulldog for truth. I mean, he wants to know the facts. And so it was a privilege to have him. And also, he believes in a greater spiritual reality. I mean, he's not just talking to the deceased. And that's a wonderful thing that our consciousness continues like the light from distant stars. But he also believes in the greater spirituality, including guides and angels and all of that. And he was one of the people who pushed me to start doing research in this area. And he also believes in the sacred, the source, the universal consciousness.
Well, let me read just a portion of what he wrote.
Sure.
It says, this book forces the readers to examine their own life experiences and question them and take responsibility for their thoughts and actions. It enables you to live a life that is unfolding with assistance from the invisible elephant in the room known as spirit. So he hits it right on the head.
Yeah, but in fact, I have to thank you for reminding me that, because it really is the invisible elephant in the room. And it's not just the imagined elephant, it's the real elephant.
Well, you know, I was reading that portion, and I was thinking about Harry Houdini as he made the elephant disappear in the hippodrome in the UK. And lo and behold, you may be in touch with Harry Houdini.
Yes, and I didn't
Weird.
Yes, that is outrageously weird, and leave it to you to see the connection. By the way, that's one of the great things about being able to do things in depth with people who care about depth, is that they're as much a teacher as they are a listener.
Yeah.
So thank you. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Harry, since you brought him up with regard to the elephant and making the elephant disappear, and John Edward talking about the elephant in the room. Harry Houdini was actually sort of a hero of mine when I was a child. I was fascinated with magic and so on. And I actually saw, I don't know if you ever saw the movie.
The Tony Curtis movie?
Yes.
Absolutely. Loved it.
You loved it. Okay, well, I loved it too as a kid. Now, later, much later, I learned that Harry Houdini had a deep interest in this whole question of life after death. And he, along with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, they developed a very special friendship. Now, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle became a spiritualist. He became convinced that the evidence was sufficiently strong that there was a greater spiritual reality. Harry Houdini really wanted to believe that there was a greater spiritual reality, but he was also aware that there were a lot of frauds. And there are frauds today.
And he was out to expose them.
And he was out to expose them, and he did.
Yeah.
And he revealed, a lot of these. But he was not just out to become famous for being a fraud detector. He was really searching to find someone who was genuine, because he really wanted to believe that his mother's essence, her consciousness and energy, still existed. So, and they had this friendly debate about this, okay? Now, I learned about this as an adult.
And he was almost obsessed with it.
I would say he was obsessed with it.
Yeah.
I think that's very well put. And I suspect he would agree with us. In fact, someday we're going to ask him. And I'm going to blame it on you. I'm going to say, hey, George mentioned this on the radio. He brought up the connection. Can you give us an answer? So, anyway, now let's go to the present.
And he'll say, they still have radios in those days?
That's very funny. Okay, so, present day. A couple of years ago, here I am now dealing with all this secret material, which is being revealed in the Sacred Promise for the first time. There's all this stuff going on, including celebrities getting to me via mediums. Now, by the way, just a sidebar here before we talk about Harry, is that, it's difficult enough for most people, especially scientists, to imagine that our mothers or grandmothers or children who have gone before us, their consciousness is still here. But we find it even more difficult to imagine that somebody who's famous, be they quote, distinguished, like an Einstein, or infamous, like some other celebrities, that they're still here.
Right, right.
We find it even more difficult to imagine that, light travels for millions or billions of years, and the reason why we can see stars at night is because that information travels and it doesn't lose its integrity in the vacuum of space, the, quote, vacuum of space. So millions or billions of years is nothing for a photon, okay? Now, given that that's the case, the same thing should apply to our photons. So consequently, it shouldn't matter whether we're talking to somebody, let's say Einstein, or Isaac Newton, or Pythagoras. It doesn't matter who the person is. What's a couple of thousand years for a photon?
Nothing.
Nothing. So therefore, the notion that historic figures, not only could their consciousness exist, but that they could care enough about the continued evolution of humanity and this planet to have made a sacred commitment to continue to be of assistance. The fact that that could be the case, which it seems almost unimaginable to us, and it's such a beautiful thought, but it's plausible. Okay, so I had to become open to all of this. And I confessed earlier on in the book, and we'll probably get to this, in that, I start with the question of, if Einstein's mind still exists, how would he prove that he's still here? Put yourself in Einstein's shoes. And the reason is because multiple mediums for years have been telling me that Einstein was coming to them, that he had messages for humanity, and he had some specific messages for me. And I had a difficult enough time accepting that my adopted grandmother, Susie Smith, was coming through. But Einstein? He wants to talk to me? Anyway, Harry Houdini. So all of this is going on. And then synchronicities started happening related to Harry Houdini. And I began to wonder, is he here too? And so I then started doing some secret science, meaning I did it privately. I did it as a research, in a thorough research manner. But it was done, for example, in the privacy of our home. And what I did was with a senior colleague and also my beloved, Ron Eklund Schwartz, we actually had a research medium, for example, come to the house, and we did a what's called a single-blind experiment where we actually asked the deceased Susie Smith to bring some secret people to the reading. So the medium had to contact Susie, and Susie had to bring Harry.
Huh.
All right? And then what we did was we had the medium had to read Susie, and then Susie had to pass on this person, and then the medium had to connect with this person. And I'm not going to go through all this now. We have a paper that's been submitted for publication about this, and hopefully we'll know soon about this. But anyway, it was a pair of readings. In this set of readings, the evidence was amazing about the evidence in favor of the fact that Harry Houdini was actually here. But of course, a mediumship reading, even if it's done under triple blind conditions, you're still going to question it. You're going to still wonder, well, is it really the mind of the experimenter? I mean, what's causing this? There are alternative paranormal explanations. That's where the technology comes in. Because when I started using, for example, these silicon photomultiplier systems, and we published our first paper on this a few months ago in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, if you read that paper, which is available at drgaryschwartz.com, and more importantly, it's in the book, The Sacred Promise, in a much more readable form. In the paper, it's really funny, I gave everybody initials. I didn't say who the alleged spirits were. But the editor found it hard to follow. So he said, can't you use names?
Use the names, yeah.
So what I did was I used the names without identifying them. So what I pointed out was that in the second, there were three sets of experiments. In the second experiment, one of the two spirits, alleged spirits, was, scientists always say alleged or hypothesized or, you know, spirits. It said Harry. Of course, they didn't know it was Harry Houdini. It was Harry. So if I said it was Harry Houdini, they probably would have rejected the paper. So I said it was Harry. And then in the third experiment, which was the proof of concept experiment about whether this could be used as a communication device, I chose Harry. You know why?
Okay.
Because he was so good. The data indicated that he had extraordinary capability, more than virtually any of the alleged spirits that we had tried and, you know, initially tested.
Well, you know, he was so obsessed with trying to find out if it existed, he's probably equally obsessed to let us know it does.
Yes, and also he was a perfectionist in life. He practiced his art over and over. He was a master of disguises, a master of getting escape artist. He had tremendous strength. And you know what I always say is that people who are bigger than life in this life are bigger than life in the next. In other words, your personality and qualities continue. As well. Of course, they can grow and change, but they also continue. So if anybody is going to come through in spades, we would hypothesize that it would be Harry Houdini. Now, the last thing about this is, and you have to understand, as a scientist, I'm always skeptical about this, not as in the debunking or dismissing skepticism, which is not real skepticism, but in the skepticism, which is true skepticism, which is questioning.
Let's get into that, the questioning of this whole test, when we come back. I'm just wild about Harry. Gary, let's go back to him.
Okay.
So you did this work through Harry,
right?
And tell us what happened.
Well, as I was sharing with you in the first published research, when we were exploring the idea of using this supersensitive technology for this novel purpose, as fate would have it, it turned out that when he was invited to participate, he was a quote star. But what was truly extraordinary, and this is described in the book, is that I really couldn't believe it was him. I have a hard time believing any of this stuff, to tell you the truth, despite all of the data. And so I'm always questioning, can it be real? How could this be so? How can we verify it better? And I was having a meeting with some of my colleagues and supporters at Canyon Ranch, which is an international wellness corporation. And I shared what appeared to be the case with regard to, by the way, we refer to him as HHH, Hypothesized Harry Houdini. And I was speaking with one of the senior members, and he said, you know, he says, you're showing me all these data with this increased numbers of sums of these photons over time. He said, but does he ever produce large magnitude responses? Does anyone ever produce, instead of increased frequency of these, they look like bursts, do they ever produce really large magnitude ones? He said, like baseball. You know, does anybody ever get a triple or a home run, not just get on base? And I said, well, I really haven't seen that. But anyway, what I've been doing, and part of the reason why I think I was so successful, is I would leave the equipment running, and I would have these sessions, which I called free play or practice. And I said, look, I'm going to be gone for a couple of hours or overnight. Mm-hmm. You guys play with it. You get practice with this, because they have to learn how to do this. I treat it like any sport or any musical skill. And by the way, you know, we have to learn how to talk. We have to learn how to use a keyboard. We have to learn how to communicate. We have to learn how to play instruments. So maybe they had to learn to use this technology. So anyway, I come back from the meeting. I had another meeting. I walk into the laboratory, because I was originally doing this in my home laboratory before I was doing it at the university. And I walk in, and the graph is off the scale. See, normally these pulses are about they're not really pulses, but they're sums of photons. They would be like 12 units or 25 units in magnitude. And I walked in, and the scale was like at 175. So what happened was that instead of the 25 filling up the screen, the tall screen, you know, the high screen, they were just little tiny things. I couldn't figure out, how could that be? Was it an artifact? Was it an error? I'm talking about Harry Houdini and possibility of doing something like a home run. And then I walk into the house, and something odd occurs. So after my meeting, I'm sitting and I'm having dinner, and I was going to give a lecture at Canyon Ranch that night. And I'm saying in my head, I said, Harry, are you here? Did you do this? Well, if you could you do another one? And I'm just sitting there quietly. I'm just looking at the screen. And all of a sudden, bingo, 173 sum occurs. You have to understand, they're all 25 or 12. And now bingo is off the scale. And what happened was, in those days, I had because it was a year ago, I had a video camera that also took stills available, so I could click a button and take a picture of the screen, which means it wasn't a very good picture.
Right.
But at least it was the evidence. So I captured this, because I had never seen this before. And I said, God, that's the second one. And I witnessed this when I was thinking in my head about, could Harry do this? So, of course, I was dumbstruck by this. But anyway, I had to go off and give my lecture. So I went off to Canyon Ranch at 8 p.m. and gave my lecture. I think it was on the energy healing experiments. Then I came home at night, and, you know, the equipment's running, and it's all back to its normal state. And then I invited Rhonda into the room, and I said, I have to see things at least three times before I take them seriously.
And Rhonda's your wife, right?
And Rhonda's my wife. And by the way, she has a new book out called Love Eternal, which maybe we'll get to later. And which relates to all of this. And anyway, we're sitting there, and I said, could this be Harry? I mean, is this really him? So, you know, we're talking out loud, and I said, Harry, could you show us again that you did this? Within a minute, bingo, there it was again, the third time. And I took a picture of that. And at this point now, I was forced to entertain the hypothesis of one of three things. Either it was a super coincidence, just a total anomaly.
Which, you know, I don't believe in.
Which I know you don't believe in, but you remember, we always have to raise this as a question and rule it out. The second was, somehow it was my mind that was doing this. That because I was thinking about it, it was my unconscious mind or my conscious mind that could produce this. And by the way, I've sat at that screen and for hours tried to do things by myself. And I get zip. But you have to try. And the third possibility is, yes, HHH, Hypothesized Harry Houdini, is here. And he's, in some respect, no different than Susie Smith or Marcia Eklund, which is Rhonda's mother, or any spirit, any formerly physical person who cares deeply about loved ones on the earth and the earth itself. And science has the potential to reveal it. And then the question becomes, how do skeptics address this kind of data?
I would bet that if these spirits are real, mm-hmm. that they would love the opportunity to try to get information to people who are trying to help.
Yes. And that's, of course, part of the notion of the sacred promise, is that imagine for the moment that you and I are spirits. We have now, we are theoretically spirits. We're in a physical body right now. But let's say that we're post-physical, meaning that we've, quote, died. Now we're in the spirit world. And there are either specific people, children or grandchildren or dear friends or someone that you have messages to, or you're the kind of person who is service-oriented, or you really care about the planet, and you have a mission. It's part of your calling to be of assistance. Wouldn't you want to, particularly if you had information that could help humanity, wouldn't you want to get that information back to your loved ones or back to the world in general? Of course. And the notion is that they are eager to make connections with us, particularly at this state, this precarious state that we are living in at the moment. You know, many of us believe and act as if we live in a spiritless universe, and we feel very hopeless.
Why don't they move on? Gary, I always thought that a spirit eventually is gone.
Right, and by the way, many of them, quote, do move on. I mean, why hang around, especially if nobody's listening to them? I mean, how would you feel?
I'd hate to go on the air if there was nobody listening.
Exactly.
Thank God I don't have to worry about that.
Right, you've got listeners. But imagine for the moment, let's say that you're a mother and you've got a daughter you love, and you really want to be there to continue to care for her. Or you've got a child who died, and the child wants to be with you. But you're oblivious to this child. You know, you're going to only call out so many times, and when you're not heard, you're going to move on. However, imagine for the moment that at least some of us are open. And by the way, more and more people are becoming open and having more of these kinds of experiences. And then imagine that there were a few scientists who are taking this seriously, my lab being one of them, and now there's actually the possibility of being heard, and there's a pressing, need.
Do they tell other spirits?
That's what it appears to be the case.
We're not going to believe this. This doctor here, he's opened up our phone lines. Let's go.
And that's happening now in spades. We keep having more and more evidence of what are called, quote, drop-ins in the scientific jargon of unknown people showing up.
Unannounced?
Unannounced, and who you never would have expected. And they don't even show up once, but they end up becoming, if you would, a member of the extended family or extended team. But let me get back to how this could apply, like, in our personal lives. Because this is, one of the things we talk about in the book is how spirit can play a role in protecting us.
Sure.
That's one of the things that spirit can do.
And heal us. I want to get into that.
Yeah, we want to get into the healing. Okay. So let's talk about protection first. I give examples of how that can happen. And one of the examples I share is from my own personal life. And I'll just give the story quickly. I was asked to be an invited guest to be interviewed on a possible television show that was being created to replace the Rosie O'Donnell show. And this person who I'll keep nameless, who very well known, former Harvard undergraduate and so on, supposedly was interested in the topic. And he was going to, and he wanted to have me talk about a book I wrote about this topic. And I agreed to do so, but only under the condition that he actually read the book. I said, look, the producer, I said, I'm willing to do this, but you have to promise that he's actually going to read the book.
Right.
He's going to interview me on the air. I want to read the book or at least skim it.
And know something about what he's talking about.
And know something about what I'm talking about.
Sure.
Otherwise, why waste my time going on television being interviewed by somebody who hasn't really looked at it? And she said, well, I can't 100% promise, but I'll try. And then she said, well, do you have any, mediums that you think might be willing to go on? Because we'd really like to talk to some research-oriented meetings. So I did. One of them, by the way, was a woman who likes me to talk about her publicly. Her name is Suzanne Northrup, who is a phenomenal medium who I worked with in the past and continue to be connected with in the present. And the I get to this, I fly to California for this pilot show taping, and a medium says to me, she says, Gary, she says, I want you to know Susie here. Now, Susie is this woman who had passed, who we'll maybe talk about a bit, who is my adoptive grandmother, who published 30 books in the field of parapsychology and life after death. She says, Susie's here, and she says she's got an urgent message for you. I said, what? She says, she's telling you that you have to be prepared to be ambushed. Ambushed.
The dead?
Yes.
Susie Smith.
The dead Susie Smith.
Tells this medium all right,
to prepare me to be ambushed.
You're going
to
be ambushed.
I'm going to be ambushed.
Verbally or physically?
I didn't know. I've never heard anything like this before. I said, ambushed. I said, okay, well, I'm going to keep my ears open. Because at this point, I'd had enough, quote, warnings through multiple mediums, allegedly from Susie, that turned out to be true, that I'm not going to just dismiss this. You know, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and keep my eyes open. Well, I'll just jump ahead here. When the time finally came for me to be interviewed by this gentleman, who had already shown his cards, for example, when he went to the audience to start this, he said, how many of you think there's a possibility that consciousness continues after the death? And about two-thirds of the audience, I'll say, raised their hand. And then he said, how many of you are unsure? And maybe another, I don't remember what the percentage was, she'll raise her hand. And he said, how many of you are smart and know better and know that this is all a fantasy and there is no life after death? And then the rest of them proudly raised their hands, the disbelievers. And I said, well, it sounds to me like maybe he has a bias. Well, he comes in and he sits down next to me. And he said to me, he said, Dr. Schwartz, he said, did you go to do your undergraduate work at Harvard College? I said, no. I said, I explained in the book, I did my my undergraduate work at Cornell. I said, I did my PhD at Harvard. He said, so you didn't go to Harvard College? I said, no. And he said, well, then I'm not going to tell people that you have your PhD from Harvard. And I said, why? And he said, because you've lied about your credentials. I said, I've lied about my – you have to understand, no one has ever accused me of lying about my credentials. They've accused me of all kinds of things. So he's saying to this me privately, just whispering in my ears. I said, you're saying I lied about my credentials? I said, did you read this book? And he said, well, of course not. He said, why would I read a book? Why would I believe somebody if they lie about their credentials? Then the music starts. And all of a sudden, the music goes on, and there are 100 people, hundreds of people in the audience.
Right.
He gets up and he says, well, now I want you to tell that Dr. Schwartz is here, and he's going to talk about this book that he's recently written. He said, Dr. Schwartz, he said, could you please tell us who you are and what your position is? I said, well, Gary Schwartz from the – and I'm a professor of psychology, medicine, neurology, psychiatry, and surgery at the University of Arizona. And he said, do you do surgery? I said, of course not. I said, I'm a psychologist. And he said, so you don't teach surgery? I said, of course I don't teach surgery. He said, well, then you can't be a professor of surgery, and therefore you've lied about your credentials. And I said, excuse me.
And this is in front of everybody.
Well, this is in front of everybody. The cameras are rolling. I said, excuse me. I said, are you aware that PhD psychologists or physiologists or other fields can have joint appointments, collaborative, and they can be even full professorships like mine? Because the work that you do is relevant to either research in the area
mm-hmm.
or the teaching of certain aspects, like the psychology of healing as it relates to surgery. And he said, Dr. Schwartz, do you teach surgery? I said, no. And he said, well, you've lied about your credentials and you've therefore lied about your book. At which point I said, I was on the one hand.
You didn't know whether to get up and leave or
exactly.
what.
Exactly. But because I had had the warning of being ambushed, I immediately now understood what was happening because I'd been warned.
Right.
So I said to him, I said, I understand you went to Harvard College. Is that correct? He said, yes.
You said that to him?
Yes. I now interview him.
Okay.
You have to understand, he's now accused me of this. And I said, Do you know what Harvard's motto is? He said, of course. And I said, what is it? He said, well, it's Veritas. I said, what does Veritas mean? I said, it means truth. I said, good. I said, here's what I want you to do. I said, after the show is over, I want you and your staff to contact the University of Arizona. And I want you to, in fact, confirm that I have all of these joint appointments, that this is really true. And then on your next show, if you have a next show, I want you to apologize to your audience for making this egregious mistake. And he said, absolutely not. At which point, the interview went downhill from there.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, after this, you have to understand that the audience, of course, is stunned.
They don't know what to do.
They don't know what to do. The audience, of course, is stunned. And I walk up, the producer comes up to me, and she says, Dr. Schwartz, she said, I am so sorry. She said, I had no idea that he was going to do this. She said, I really apologize. She said, oh, by the way, Dr. Schwartz, she said, you know, a mistake was made, and we forgot to fax you, you know, the signed consent releasing this. And I said, isn't that convenient? I said, you know, normally I just sign these things because an interview is an interview. I said, but here's what I want to do. I said, please send me this form. I said, I'm going to have a lawyer look at
it. Good for you.
I said, because I think that your potential host slandered me or libeled me or whatever the legal term is for all of this. And I said, you know, I'm not going to do anything and give my permission for any of this until I take a look at it. As you can probably imagine, they never faxed me that form. That pilot never aired.
Never aired. Nobody saw it other than the audience.
Meanwhile, I'm saying to myself, if that medium hadn't had that spontaneous moment where somebody who cared about me came through to warn me.
You would have fallen apart.
Yes. I would not have been able to handle it with the preparation that I did. And that's just one, and that's real life, okay? It's real life. And because I'm a scientist, I observe these things very closely. I record them. I get people, whenever you can get independent verification to do so, I do, you know, real experiments that we can talk about in my personal life and so on. But once you start knowing that the opportunities to receive this information, and sometimes it'll come through a professional medium, sometimes it comes through people who are not, quote, professional, but they just have this intuitive sense, and they give you this information. Sometimes it can come to you yourself if you're open to receiving it. And all of us have this capability to be, if you would, receivers for this kind of information to various
people. How many people, though, don't recognize that intuitive spirit that's coming to them?
Well, my experience in the academic world is virtually everybody. I mean, most scientists and most people in the academic world, which is the world that I've lived in for most of my, you know, professional life, are utterly immune to all of this.
Yeah,
they think it's impossible. They don't believe it's either true. They would be embarrassed to talk about it. You know, there's a so-called giggle factor about all of this.
Hold on, Gary. We'll be back. I can't believe how fast this night's going. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Gary Schwartz on Coast to Coast AM. Gary, where do angels and spirit guides fit into this?
Well, that's a wonderful question. The first of all, angels and guides are, for many professional mediums, something that they deeply believe in. For example, Mary Occhino, who for many years did a five-day-a-week radio show, a hit radio show on Sirius XM Radio called Angels on Call. Mary, who, by the way, was raised Catholic, so she would be open to this kind of idea, she became convinced that this angelic realm was playing a significant role in her life. And another person, John Edward, for example, or Suzanne Northrup. These people who deserve to be listened to because they had already been, as John put it, in the hot seat. They had participated in many experiments, been tested over and over, and had passed muster. When they start telling me with a straight face that they're getting information and assistance and that some of their great capabilities come because they're getting assistance from these forms, you know, I have to listen to this. I should listen to this as a scientist. Meanwhile, you know, as I said earlier, I was raised to believe that it was that angels were like Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny, you know, and so I thought it was all silly. But then, as I confess in this book, and we could spend a significant amount of time on this, the wonderful stories, I became led to the possibility that that the, quote, angelic realm, and by the way, angel is simply a word that means messenger.
That's right.
It is. That's all it is. And the fact that historically sometimes people have seen beings that look like they have wings, which they may or may not have wings, and other people have said that angels can take any form possible.
And those winged creatures could be something entirely different.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole, we could get into that at a later time, which is relevant also to your show, the whole business of, quote, extraterrestrials, whatever we mean by these
mm-hmm.
things. But these beings, whatever they are, these higher energy beings, that they could be as real as photons of light. And so I began to do research in that question. Again, secretly, that's how it started. And it started partly in my personal life, which I confess in the book. And by the way, this little sidebar here. I first began taking it seriously when a postdoctoral fellow who was joining my laboratory came to meet me for the first time. We had spoken on the phone, but I had never met this person before. And when this person sat down, and I can't even remember the pseudonym I gave him in the book because he wanted to keep his identity anonymous. So I changed certain things to protect him. He said, you know, he said, by the way, he said, Gary, I should tell you that I see spiritual beings. And he said, I'd like you to know that your angel is here. And he's behind your right shoulder, I think he said. And he has a message for you and like to meet you. I mean, she'd like to meet me. Now, in all the years that I've been doing research, no one has told me that there was an angel in my office.
Huh.
This was, obviously the first time.
This was the first time.
And I immediately had the question, was this person pulling my leg? Was this person hallucinating? Or was it possible that there really was an angel, that this person who was actually a gifted healer and so on, and had turned out to be doing this throughout his lifetime, was very serious about this. And then there were people like Mary Otino who, on the radio would tell me that her angels were providing assistance. I'll give you a phenomenal example. This is just so amazing what Mary did. Rhonda was working on a draft of her book called Love Eternal. And I was on a trip on the East Coast. And she called me and told me that there was something crazy happening around the house. I mean, crazy in the sense that it was very unusual, meaning, and it had to do with this bird, which we thought was a, quote, flicker. We later learned it was a woodpecker. This bird was flying at the window, and it was pecking, trying to get in. And it did it on and off all day. This, we're not talking about 2 minutes, 5 minutes. We're talking it all day. Now, she was writing this book about what happened to her after her mother passed and all of these events that happened, which she chronicled in detail in a very careful diary. And she had connections with birds with her mother, okay? And anyway, this bird is doing this very odd thing. So I said, you've got to take pictures of this. You take pictures for a long. We need the evidence. This went on for 4 days. 4 days. Hundreds of pictures, morning, noon, midday and mm-hmm. late afternoon. Okay, so there's this odd moment with the bird. Who knows what it is? I come home, she shows me the pictures, and then on Friday, I used to do a segment, sort of science with Dr. Schwartz. She used to call me her Yoda. She would, Mary Otino, and I was, and every now and again on the radio show, I would ask, Mary questions, because she did online readings. So I asked Mary if she and her angels could give us, give me any information about what had been going on lately. I didn't say anything, utterly vague. But I mean, if I told you what's going on lately, unless you've got a video camera in the house, you're not going to know. And so she tells me that her angels are showing to her that that Susie's here, and Susie's with this other woman, and this other woman is important. And then she says, this other woman sounded like Rhonda's mother. And then she said, they're showing me there's a woodpecker, and it's on the roof of your house. Something about a woodpecker, and this is important, and you'll know what it means. But you have to understand, I've witnessed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of research readings. Do you think they ever bring up woodpeckers?
Never.
Never, of course not. And I'm listening to this, supposedly coming from her angel assistants, and I'm saying to myself, well, it's close. It's not a woodpecker, it's a flicker. it's not a woodpecker, but it's close. They then took the pictures and showed it to someone who knew about birds, an authority on birds. Of course, what was it? It was a woodpecker. Now, when you witness those kinds of moments in your life enough times, you can either say, well, they're wonderful and celebrate them, of course, or you can dismiss them. Or in my case, you can say, maybe I need to bring this into the laboratory. So in this chapter in the book, which I confess, testing angels in the laboratory, we actually began to do research and began using a particular kind of one of the devices that we used, by the way, was the silicon photomultiplier system. And in the experiment 2 of the paper that was published in this journal, that paper included 2 specific alleged spirits. One, HHH, hypothesized Harry Houdini, and the other was this alleged angel. And the angel, the alleged angel, actually did even better than Harry.
Huh.
And in subsequent research, which will be coming up very shortly, which is probably the most extraordinary research I've ever done in my entire academic career, which now spans a very long period of time. Let me explain that, and your listeners, I think, will really appreciate this. Most of the time when we do research, somebody is interacting with the equipment. There's a physical person present. So I could be doing an experiment, for example, or my research assistant could be doing an experiment, whoever. And the problem is, how do you know whatever you get, whether it's somehow the mind or the energy of the experimenter, and not the energy, for example, of the alleged spirit? It's always a problem. Well, if this device is, this equipment is like, let's say, a cell phone, you don't have to pick up your cell phone for the cell phone to ring. You can have the ringer off. The voicemail will take the message whether you take the call or not. If there's a real caller calling, you don't even have to know that the caller is calling. So the idea occurred to me, well, if this is true, if the angel is really showing up, or if Harry's really showing up, as 2 examples, and they're really working with us, or Susie, whoever the beings are, then theoretically, if they're really made a sacred promise to participate in this research, they should be able to come into the laboratory in the evening when nobody's present, follow instructions provided by PowerPoint, visual,
that's right,
and auditory, mimicking or modeling what a live experimenter would do, and they should be able to produce the same results even when no human being is present, when no human being knows when the computer is started, because the computer, well, it starts at a fixed time, let's say at 11 p.m., which is coincidental since we're started here at 11 p.m. Pacific Coast time. And the computer then randomly picks a number to when it's actually going to start the PowerPoint. So no human being ever knows when the experiment's going to officially begin. Meanwhile, these beings, like the angel, have been instructed toward the end of the day with a script, a very warm, loving script, reminding them there's an experiment tonight and they promise to show up. We're treating them like with respect like we would because we're doing sacred research. And then eventually the PowerPoint comes on and it will say, for example, a welcome angel thank you for showing up. And as you know, in the past, the first part of the data, don't go into the chamber. Just stay away. We're collecting baseline. And in this case, we'd be using what's called a low-light CCD camera, cooled to minus 77 degrees centigrade, which is very cold, looking into a pitch-black environment and detecting, literally imaging, getting a two-dimensional picture of the background light. And then it would say, okay, angel, now please go into the chamber, and for the next half hour, please stay there and let your light glow while the camera collects the data, and we'll tell you when it's done. And then, of course, we'll collect the post-baseline, and then they'll be thanked and asked to leave. And what we do is we had this particular angel invited.
Can you see a face?
What?
Can you see a face when you do something like that?
That's really interesting. I'm going to get there in a second. Let me just finish the story, and then I'll tell you, because that's really important. The In this particular experiment, on some of the trials, the angel would be invited, and on other of the trials, a deceased person would be invited. We were interested, could we detect both, and was there a difference? And then the next morning, the research assistant would come back into the room, and there the data would be collected, at which point then we would analyze the data. So remember, there's no human being present. Now, if this really is spirit, we should get the same results, whether the experimenter was running the experiment physically present or not. And much to my absolute amazement, and we have a paper that's coming out momentarily in a peer-reviewed journal about this, I ran the experiment three times and after we had done all this pilot research, and we got continued positive results. And the interesting thing was the angelic presence was consistently producing a bigger effect than the non-angel spirit. Now, getting back to your profound question. The very first time I tried this, and this was not with the computer, this was with the experimenter present, was I asked my research assistant to invite an angel, a particular angel, to come into the laboratory. So, you know, we'd get a baseline for a half hour, and then he would invite this angel for a half hour, and then we get another baseline. You get pre the intervention, you know, the spirit presence alleged, and then the post, okay? Now, you have to understand that, well, you know, I'm explaining, is that in this very first experiment, it's a pitch-black chamber in a pitch-black room. It's completely dark. And in there, we had a chessboard, kind of checkerboard background that the camera was focused on. And this is the kind of camera, by the way, that these telescopes use to look out into deep space. Our camera costs $40,000. So this is, you know, astrophysics.
Yeah, that's not cheap.
No, it's not cheap. And what happens, of course, when you look at these pictures, I mean, the half-hour exposures, like when you're looking out into deep space, what you see is this very hint of a checkerboard. This is the white will reflect more whatever the background light is compared to the black, even though it's completely pitch black. Okay, in that environment, for all practical purposes, the camera is so sensitive it picks up the subtle differences. And what you see is fuzz. Now we were looking for. I didn't know what I was looking for. I didn't know what was going to be just sheer brightness, whether it was going to be structure. So anyway, I'm staring at this image, being completely open-minded, and being open to the possibility that I might see a form. And what I noticed was that when in the picture, the image, you know, this half-hour exposure with the alleged angel, at an angle, left to right, when I twisted my head sideways. Do you remember the movie Contact?
Yeah, one of my favorites.
One of my favorites, too. And they had to twist the image to finally be able to get it upright.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm twisting because I watched that movie many times, too. I was very inspired by it. And I'm looking at this, and I'm making out what looks like, you know, a vague stereotype of an angelic figure. Now, here's the problem. Sort of using, you know, the kind of software that they did, with image processing enhancement software, which we ultimately did, I'll tell you about momentarily, it could be like a Rorschach, right?
Yeah.
And it could be like reading an X-ray. It may take great skill to be able to know what details to look for. Now, I've been looking at these images for years because we've been using this camera to measure what's called biophoton light, light emitted by, for example, plants in the pitch black. So we're looking at living systems emitting light all the time as part of our energy research, and so applying it to this, if you would, the spiritual realm was partly a natural extension. I have a lot of skills by looking at X-rays, but I didn't know whether this was really, you know, my imagination or not. And then using software, which is actually you can get for free. Any of your listeners could go to National Institutes of Health, and if you look up ImageJ, ImageJ, those five, six letters, ImageJ and NIH, it'll take you to the software, which is free for medical researchers, biomedical researchers, for image processing. And it turned out one of the things that's provided in this software is what's essentially called spectral analysis or fast Fourier analysis of these images, which then allows you to look for structure. And when I did that, you see this band of structure that's visible to the naked eye.
I would have freaked if you had seen an image with horns.
Yeah, by the way, fortunately, that was not the case, although I haven't been looking for images with horns.
No, I wonder if that's possible.
By the way, in theory, get back to Sacred Promise, all this and more is possible.
Yeah.
And that's what's so exciting about this. This gets back to the, so let's jump ahead to your question about is it possible. That's why I use the expression, so let's, by the way, take-home message. I've done all these experiments now. I've given you the introduction to all of this. And everything points to the fact that we can literally measure the presence of what appear to be angelic beings, and we can discriminate them from the typical deceased. Right? They're different. Again, you'll get the details by reading the papers. So, Sacred Promise, possibility here.
Are they helpers?
Well, the ones that we're working with are certainly helpers. I mean, they are. These are the kinds of. Okay, perfect example. Can I please share this? I love this. Thank you. Have you heard of what's called St. Anthony?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I learned about St. Anthony through Mary Occhino when I first met her. I had never heard of St. Anthony. He's the patron saint of missing objects or lost objects. And Catholics, you know, typically will call on St. Anthony to help them find things. So I've heard all kinds of stories. Some of them, of course, are just silly and not verifiable. But others come from very credible people and on replicated basis. And Rupert Sheldrake, a very distinguished parapsychologist and biologist from England, he refers to St. Anthony as the patron saint of parapsychology. Anyway, the question is, can these angels or saints or even our loved ones become helpers? And the answer is yes. In the book, The Sacred Promise, I actually tell this remarkable story, which I learned from Rhonda, which she recounts in much greater depth in her book coming out next month called Love Eternal, where after her mother died, there was a particular insurance policy, I'll do it very quickly, that was critical in order to verify that so this insurance company would actually pay what they were supposed to pay, because they didn't have a record of it. And they claimed that if they didn't have a record of it, unless she had a record of it, they wouldn't follow through. And Rhonda searched the house top to bottom and couldn't find it. She looked everywhere, she thought. And then because she'd been having these anomalous experiences and because she was open to this, she then invited her mother to help her find this, and she asked God. And when we come back, I will tell you what happened.
All right. Gary, I want to get into the Wright Brothers moment in a moment, and we'll take calls, but I want you to finish your thoughts on the angel stories you were talking
sure.
about.
So, by the way, I thought it was curious that that you're from the, quote, city of angels, and here we are talking about angels and assistants. And
synchronicity is everywhere.
Yeah. Someday I hope that I get to interview you someday, because I would much prefer to hear your stories than be telling mine. But anyway, so Rhonda has this, she needs to find this policy. She's looked everywhere she would think to look and didn't find it. And then she asked this question in her head. And she heard a voice. And the voice said, go into my office and go open the closet. And you'll look down and you'll see your father's flag. And behind the flag, you will find this policy. Now, who would think to find a policy behind an old flag? And as Rhonda tells this, shares this thing, and she describes it, and I describe it in the book and much more in hers, she hears this voice, and this peace came over, essentially.
A calming peace.
A calming peace. And she knew that she had to trust this, and she also said that if she goes into the room and opens her closet and goes to that flag, if it's behind there, the world will never be the same to her again. Her consciousness will be transformed. She went in, opened the closet, saw the flag, found there was a couple of papers behind there. And one of those was the missing insurance policy.
Jeez.
And so, and the book is filled with examples of these kinds of moments. And what's wonderful is you can bring this into the laboratory. Multiple mediums have told me that there are I call them alleged angels, hypothesized angels, and they're as eager to participate in this research as Harry Houdini or Albert Einstein or Susie Smith or Marcia Eklund. That if there is this greater spiritual reality, it's up to them. You know, people ask me the question, they say, you know, Dr. Schwartz, are you trying to prove that a greater spirituality exists, be it deceased people or angels or the source? And I say, absolutely not. What I'm trying to do is to give them, if they exist, the opportunity to prove themselves. My job as a scientist is to just be like a gardener. You know, let's say you want to find out whether a seed can grow. You're going to be a good gardener. What do? You provide soil, you provide light, you provide
fertilizer,
water.
Fertilizer, you do it all.
Exactly. You provide the optimum conditions for the seed to grow, and then it's up to the seed. And the seed will either be a real seed or it'll be a fake seed. It'll be a vital seed or it will not. And yet, it's up to the seed, and the seed's either there or it's not. Okay? That's the approach that I take. And the remarkable thing is, if you provide the optimal conditions, what this book clearly points to is that we're experiencing a Wright Brothers moment.
And what is that?
Well, you know, a little over 100 years ago, there were no airplanes. And human beings have been trying for hundreds, if not thousands of years, to fly. And many people tried, as you know, and they got disastrous results. And then the Wright Brothers, 1903, December, in Kitty Hawk, five people witnessed that plane fly. Just five. If I remember the history. The first flight lasted for all of 12 seconds. 12 seconds. Longest, I think, was 59 seconds. The next day, they tried to replicate it. They couldn't. Plane didn't fly. It wasn't enough wind because it took a minimal amount of breeze to get them up. The third day, it did. Now, anyone who was there, and there was very few people, anyone who witnessed it, they knew now that flight was possible. Of course, many people thought it had to be impossible. They thought it was fraud or whatever. And here's what I encourage people to do. George, let's let you and I and all of your witnesses, your listeners, let's imagine that we're all at Kitty Hawk. It's 1903. We don't know anything about satellite phones and this kind of technology that we could be listening worldwide to your show. We don't know any of this. It's 1903. Do you think that we could have imagined that within a few short generations, there would be these gigantic machines carrying hundreds of people flying all around the world at speeds greater than any creature had ever, you know, moved on the Earth?
How about 66 years from then, imagining being on the moon?
Yes, well, let's get back to Wright Brothers. Could we have imagined that literally these planes would be going 24/7 and that literally every second, unless it's a storm or whatever, weather condition, somewhere a plane is landing or taking off. Literally, that's what's happening every second.
Yeah.
Could we have imagined then, 1903, that these planes would be, that millions of people would be traveling on these planes and that they would be extraordinarily safe given all this? Could we have imagined then that there'd be a brief window of time where we could get a good meal on a plane? Could we have imagined that eventually radio would come to these machines and then television? And then the sound-canceling headphones, and then computers, and ultimately the World Wide Web. And most amazing of all, we would all take it for granted. We wouldn't even think about it anymore. We don't even think twice about taking a plane anywhere. Well, I don't know about you, but I'll speak for myself. I couldn't have foreseen that 100 years ago with the knowledge that was there. And what I realized was that what we're experiencing today, and people who read the Sacred Promise book, it's like being at Kitty Hawk. That if you read this book and you learn all of this new research, both the self-science that we can all do, as well as the new technology, that we're having what I call a Wright Brothers moment. Because what we're seeing is the possibility. I call this a proof of possibility book. We are seeing the capability of that all this and more is not only real, but the question is now, can we look to the future? Can we envision what's going to happen? How far can we take this, like the soul phone? And the biggest question for me of all is, how long will it be before we all take this for granted? That's the scientific and spiritual challenge of all of this. And I must tell you, and you can sense this, I guess, in my voice, that I'm very enthusiastic about this. I mean, I think this is cause for optimism and celebration. Is it, you know, people say to me, gee, but how do you know if this is true? And I explain to people, I say, the book is not called The Sacred Proof. It's called The Sacred Promise. But we need Wright brothers. We need people who are going to try and to envision. And it's going to be a collective effort. And I think it's going to, I think your audience, by the way, is going to launch this book. You realize that? On the 11th.
There's no question about it.
You're going to launch this book. And if I could just say one appeal, and then please ask me a zillion other questions, and I'd love to take questions from the audience. Here's my hope. You know, I've written a number of other books. I've never, quote, promoted them, unquote. Meaning, I wrote them, I let them out, and then whatever happened to them happened. People came to me, including, you know, Coast to Coast. People came to me. And whatever would be, would be. But with this particular book, it's different. This book has such promise, and it could be such, we're all part of a moment. And this is the kind of book that really should be read by lots of people. It's got great opportunity. In fact, one of the things that I'm doing, because I've been an educator all this time, and what I love about your show is that it's in depth. It's not soundbite news, as the news that you were just talking about earlier on one of the commercials. This is a in-depth news, an opportunity to really explore. And what I'm actually doing is creating an 11-part mini-series on the Sacred Promise book that anybody can watch for free to invite people to really hear it in depth so that the audio and the visual complements the written. And the only way that this is going to unfold is if the public says, we want this to happen. And the way that you'll do it is your audience will Facebook people. Your audience will tell their friends. You'll read it, and if you enjoy it, you'll pass on this evidence-based hope. And, the whole complementary alternative medicine movement, the whole creating the National Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine, that happened because the public demanded it. And what I hope is that the public is going to rise to the occasion, and they're going to eventually demand that organizations like the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health, that they take this seriously, that they give it the opportunity, that they start investing some of our taxpayer money to make it possible to test all of this. Because our personal lives and the life of this planet may depend on this. And by the way, we're not just doing it for us, but we're doing it, quote, for them, the greatest spiritual reality. So anyway, I just thank you for this opportunity.
Super. And we'll take some calls. But tell me about this documentary you're involved in.
Well, you mean the miniseries?
Yeah.
Well,
what's it called, Wake Up? Or?
Actually, that's an interesting thing. The documentary Wake Up is interesting because it was this is the documentary that I briefly appear in. But it has to do with a gentleman who went on a personal journey. And he happens to be he's a skilled a movie maker and producer, and he went on this personal journey when he started seeing things. And originally, he thought he was crazy, and other people thought he was potentially crazy. And it took him on this journey where he eventually came to the conclusion that he was not crazy, or was not completely crazy, certainly, and that what he was experiencing, aspects of it were real. And that the take-home message is, quote, wake up. And and these kinds of documentaries like Wake Up or another wonderful documentary called Something Unknown is Doing We Don't Know What, which describes the five areas of parapsychology, including energy and psychic healing, which is the segment that I happen to appear in. It's a wonderful documentary. Or there's another documentary called Premonition Man, which describes this the dream detective in England and the research that was done on him, including research that we've done. These kinds of documentaries are all pointing in this direction. They're very exciting times. Challenging times, but exciting times.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Inglewood, California, first-time caller. Greg, get us started. Hi, Greg.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
All right, I like your show tonight.
Good.
Thank you.
Yeah, so listen, I got, this concept about what your guest was talking about, darkness and light, you know what I mean? How to, when you look at the sky and in the daytime, you don't see nothing but darkness is there because the sunlight is blinding us. And I was reading something about, the concept of dark and light because in the Hindu scripts, darkness is like, it's basically more powerful than light because light came from darkness. Because in the very beginning, there was nothing. It was just vacuum of space, darkness. Then kind of like God kind of blew, flipped the switch and blew himself up. And next thing you know, you have all this. So, but if you take away all the light from the universe, you got darkness. So you can't beat darkness, right?
By the way, that's a great question. Thanks for sharing that. Let me suggest that there's an interesting alternative way to look at this. And that is, remember, almost all the light frequencies that exist, we don't see. Our eyes only see a tiny spectrum. So, for example, we don't see infrared light, and we don't see ultraviolet light. And that's just, a tiny sliver of all of this. But all of that light is still there. So at night, when we're seeing darkness, the darkness is really because our eyes are actually filtered and paying attention to the tiny spectrum. If we were wearing infrared goggles, as George was talking about, which enables us to see infrared, we would know that everything is glowing in the dark. It turns out that from a photon of or a vibration point of view, there's actually light everywhere. That once, if you would, God decided to manifest and made light, that light is so brilliant. You know, in near-death experiences, people typically report that they experience this absolutely overwhelmingly bright light. And the question is, how do you explain this, especially given the fact that their cortex is electrically dead at that moment? And one possibility, of course, is it's just an artifact. It's somehow, it's just misfiring of neurons, which, of course, are not firing at all. But another possibility is what's happening is that the filtering of our eyes are no longer, we're no longer constrained by the filtering of our eyes. And so we're seeing more of the light that is there. Now, having said all that, the gift of darkness is really filtering, and with that we get discernment. So one of the, and by the way, I'm really glad that you asked this question, because one of the things it points out is that we are on an evolution of knowledge, right? That's been our whole history as a species. And although the Buddhists or the Christians or the Jews or whomever, we had wonderful mystics and we had, wonderful people of exploration, and what they experienced, the gifted ones, we should take very seriously. But the explanations for those experiences are evolving. I mean, I don't know, for example, whether Buddha knew whether the Earth was round. I don't know if Buddha knew whether the Earth actually revolves around the Sun. His experience may have been limited by his perceptions as well. So with the evolution of humanity, and with the evolution of what we call science, we can learn more and more, and therefore our spirituality can grow more and more. So when I talk about a science-based spirituality, it's really science in the service of our spiritual awakening.
Are you convinced, Gary, beyond now a shadow of a doubt, that the other side does exist?
The answer is absolutely not. Here's what I am convinced about, and I am convinced about this. I am convinced that there's a serious possibility, if not probability, that there's a greater spiritual reality. And I'm saying this as a scientist as opposed to as a person. As a scientist, I have to go by the credible scientific data, right? And if I use the standards of the profession that I'm taught, what I say is there's great promise. Now, if you ask me as a person, based on everything that in total that I've witnessed, if I have to make a guess, what am I going to vote for? No question about it. I am now convinced that if I'm going to choose and make a choice, It's the wise choice. By the way, you want to know something a little funny? Can
yeah.
I share this?
Mm-hmm. Couple minutes before.
Couple of minutes. It was my millennium resolution. I decided in the year 2000 that I was going to make a resolution for the next 1,000 years. And what I was going to do is I was going to live the rest of my life as if survival of consciousness was true. I underscore, as if survival of consciousness was true. And the reason I say this is as follows, because I realized that if it turned out that this was wrong, that I was wrong and this belief was wrong.
And it just ends, right?
Right. Then when I died, I'd never know that I was wrong.
That's right. That
because
is,
it'd be all over.
That is absolutely my approach, too.
Okay. But if there is a greater spiritual reality and my consciousness continues, then living my life as if it exists was a wise choice, because then I could start thinking about that longer-term view and live my life more responsibly, more caringly, with greater appreciation for the now, but also thinking more to the continued future. I mean, think about this. If what I'm sharing is true, someday not only are we going to potentially be able to talk to Harry Houdini or Albert Einstein or whomever with a cell phone, but more importantly, after we transition, guess what? We can look forward to actually meeting these people if they're willing to meet us. I've got all these people that I'm going to potentially get to actually know in spirit that I never knew in the physical.
They'll be sitting around a table going, what took you so long?
And they're right.
And they're right. Gary, stay with us. We're going to be back in just a moment with Gary Schwartz. We'll wrap it up with final phone calls. We're talking about his work, The Sacred Promise, right here on Coast to Coast AM. His website, by the way, is linked right to us. It's Dr. D-R, Gary, SCHWARTZ.com. We'll be right back. Gary, can these spirits help heal as well?
Can spirits help heal? The answer is, first of all, in principle, yes, theoretically, if they exist, and if they are like air and water, like we've discussed, and if they are energy like we are, then they can not only can they heal, but they're actively involved with healing. So theoretically, of course, the answer is yes. Secondly, there's been a long-standing history going, you know, throughout recorded history and continuing in the present, such as I'm sure you've heard of the person, John of God.
John of God, sure
right.
thing.
And, of course, he claims that there are 33 angels and deceased beings who are working through him. That's his belief. And, of course, all of this is scientifically verifiable in principle. And then third is you can actually bring this into the laboratory, not both the laboratory of our personal lives and the actual experimental laboratory. And then I have a section in the book, and as you know, where I talk about both the possibility of healing. I give you examples of how this I tried these things on myself, and I give examples of how other individuals have called on spirit with regard to healing. I talk about how you can actually test whether under controlled circumstances, double-blind conditions, about whether a spirit's actually present in a healing session and coming through a healer. And we've talked about how, which we probably should save for another show, hopefully, about how we can literally invite spiritual healing into us and practice exercises, like learning how to breathe, where we can actually bring this into our personal lives.
All right, let's take some calls again. Heidi in Redding, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, George.
Good to have
you. I just want to tell you I love you, and I thank you for what you do on your show.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
And Dr. Schwartz, I think you're amazing, and I thank you for being so inspirational and thought-provoking.
Thank you. By the way, before you ask your question, mm-hmm. I'm, of course, my number one goal has been to be at least thought-provoking, to trigger thought. But the idea that this particular information is potentially inspirational is, and the fact that you've said that is very meaningful, so I'm thanking you. In fact, the goal for it, we have a new website called www.sacredpromiseuniverse.com.
Oh.
And the focus of this is on information and inspiration.
Awesome. Thank you.
So thank you.
My question is to you. How do you feel about reincarnation? And the reason I ask this is you and others obviously are able to communicate with people on the other side or spirits on the other side. It's even verified now. And also research with people of after-death experiences that are brought back to life where they claim they saw loved ones there to greet them and maybe help them across to the other mm-hmm. side. How can that be if we're reincarnated?
Boy, that's a, thank you. That's a wonderful question. Let me tell you my approach to this. First of all, of course, if there is life after death, if there's a greater spiritual reality, if our energy continues like the life in distant stars, then reincarnation is possible, right?
Right.
It becomes utterly plausible.
Sure.
But now here's the big question. Is it plausible that all the energy and information that comprises who we are, which has been going out into space for our entire life, think about that movie Contact with all that information going out, is it feasible that all that information and information could be collected, energy and information, and squeezed back into a single cell? Well, from a scientific point of view, it's improbable. But here's what's more possible. What's more possible is just like a female has eggs and a male has sperm. What we can do is with our consciousness, we can seed or, you know, new beings.
Hmm.
So what we do is we, quote, reincarnate a piece of us, the hologram or the essence of us. And that essence then can grow. At the same time, the core of us that was originally here will keep on existence and growing. So maybe it's not reincarnation versus survival. Maybe it's reincarnation and survival. Now, let me tell you why I like that hypothesis. And by the way, this is testable, too. The reason why I really like that hypothesis is it helps make sense of something that I could never understand in Christianity. You know that you know, Jesus lived 2,000 years ago, and then he passed. And if all of this is true, of course, then someone like Jesus, who experienced the entire human population as his extended family, he literally experienced all of us as brothers and sisters. It's not surprising that he would care, that he wouldn't continue to care. I mean, he would be here. And, of course, we keep calling on him. By the way, this is a James Taylor song, as you know, written by Carole King, Winter, Spring, Summer, and Fall, All You Have to Do is Call, and I'll Be There. Yes, I Will. You've Got a Friend. So, anyway, how is it that Jesus could be potentially still here and in his core, that people could, quote, call on him, and simultaneously millions of people could be picking up, quote, the Jesus energy and the Jesus essence could be continuing to live on with them, including, quote, being, quote, reborn? Well, maybe it's not an either-or. Maybe it's an and. And I think that that's a viable hypothesis. What do you think?
I think you could be very right. Very right indeed. Heidi, thanks for your call.
Heidi, thank you.
Edinburgh, Texas. Jeremy, you're up with us. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Hello, Dr. Short. I just wanted to ask, what is your view and explanation on spirit possession and possessing human beings?
Wow, okay, that's a very important question, and I thank you for asking it. Theoretically, again, from a purely theoretical point of view, if spirit exists, and if we are open to receiving spirit, spirit can enter through us. Now, by the way, in mediums, there are two kinds of basic kinds of mediums. One are called mental mediums, meaning that what they do is they have a conversation with spirit, but they're not being absorbed. The spirit, you know, they're not bringing spirit in the sense of allowing them to take over their body. It's like you and I are having a conversation, but I'm not possessed by you. And then there's what's called trance mediumship. And in trance mediumship, where there's very little research on this, by the way, people claim, and I've witnessed this many times, just haven't done any systematic research in it. Here, the medium literally, their person's consciousness steps out of the way, and the new consciousness assumes them. And when this happens, people then will start taking on the voice of spirit, will take on gestures of spirit. Their handwriting can potentially look like the person who was alive, and they're, quote, taken over. Now, if that's possible, and scientifically it is possible, then we get into the instance, well, if it's possible, then could it be the case, especially if we're open to it, that we could be allowing spirit to come in and take over us? That's the scary part of the possession part. And I have to confess, and I have a whole section in the book, this book, not only about the benefit, but the risks of opening to spirit. And that is, we have to become open to the possibility that if we just open the door and let anybody in, we don't discern, that we're going to pay a price, just like we would in our physical lives. And moreover, if we're open to the possibility of inviting spirit that's violent or negative, because we ourselves are fascinated with that, we pay the price of potentially, you know the phrase, be careful for what you ask for?
That's right.
Yeah, that could happen too. Now, I think, by the way, there needs to be a very serious discussion about, you know, if there is a veil, was it put there for a reason? If there is a universal source of intelligence and wisdom, the reason why we've had such difficulty in breaking the veil is because maybe it's actually been to protect us, because we are, you know, we're like infants being given a knife, and it can be used either for curing or killing, and we don't have the wisdom yet to do this properly.
So when you talk about the faith-based evidence again, you know, all you have to do too, Gary, is, you know, you look at the universe, you look at the stars, you look at what's out there, the planets, you have to conclude that there's something much more than just our existence.
Yes, you have to. In fact, many scientists have, you know, first of all, we don't have to be a scientist to come to this conclusion, but scientists have come to this by even documenting this ever more. I mean, what I remember, you know, 25 years ago when I was a young professor at Yale, when I first heard the concept of what were called superclusters of galaxies, where they literally discovered that not only were the obviously galaxies are not random, they've got all these specific shapes and certain classes of the classic shapes, but on top of that, there was even organization to, if you think of each galaxy as a dot or a star, there were patterns or structure to the galaxies. In other words, everywhere you look, you find order. Complex, creative, but order. And where does that order come from? Obviously, you look for some sort of ordering process. So I couldn't agree with you more, George. I think that we're science, rather than taking us away from these, you know, fundamental experiences, is actually bringing us closer to it.
I think so, too. Let's go to Lisa Van Nuys, California. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
And hi to the call screener, who's really wonderful.
There you go, Tommy.
I was wondering if you could tell me the best way to ask for a miracle from the angels, because I know you've experienced them, and I have too. And I just, you know, I need a few really focused ones. So I'm wondering if you could kind of share what you feel is the best way to ask for a miracle from the angels.
Well, first of all, I must tell you, Lisa, no one has ever asked me such a question before. Of course, that's one of the joys of being able to have the privilege of doing a radio show like with George, because I have the privilege to talk to you and hear you ask that question. So the first thing I have to explain to you is that no one's ever asked me that question before. Secondly, if I were being, you know, quote, conservative, I would say, I don't know, it's a good question, sorry, don't have any science about that. Or I would say, you really should talk to somebody like a Mary Occhino or a John Edward or people who are skilled in these areas. And by the way, there are books that one can read about this. But since you deserve an answer that goes beyond that, let me share with you the possibility, my own personal experience as well as hypothesis. I think one of the things that one needs to do is to ask with genuineness. Secondly, I think one needs to be quite specific. Helps to be specific. Third, one needs to ask with humility. Fourth, I think one needs to ask with no attachment, meaning you ask particularly if it's for the best and highest good. And the reason why I say this is because often we think that we need one thing, but actually what we need is something else. And also sometimes we think that we need one thing, but our needs might be in conflict with or not be serving something else. So if there is a higher intelligence that can see this, we would hope that they could see the bigger picture and therefore be able to better coordinate these activities. There was a movie that I saw. Sometimes comedies can be actually very instructive. And one of my favorites is a But one of my favorites is actually Evan Almighty, but a previous one was Bruce Almighty. And there's this wonderful thing where Bruce is given the opportunity to be God for a while, given great responsibility. And people are asking for miracles. They all want, for example, to win the lottery. Millions of people want to win the lottery. So what does he do? He lets everybody win the lottery. And what that does is means everybody like wins 50 cents or a dollar or whatever it was. And consequently, everybody was furious because nobody got the prize. If all of us could have each of our wishes, the miracles that we wished received, we might have chaos on the earth. So what I do personally is I make my wishes known. I offer them with an open mind and heart. I hope that, you know, that they might be heard, for example. But then I, quote, release them, and I say, I'm going to put my trust or, quote, faith that not only that there is a greater spiritual reality, but that it knows much more than I do. And I will, quote, go with the flow.
All right, let's take a few more calls, Gary. Sure. We're out of time. Houston, Texas, Fred's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Fred.
Hello. How's it going tonight?
Okay, good.
Interesting answer. I've always found that if I was asking the angels for things, that I could not ask them for myself. It always had to be for others. For some reason, that way it worked.
But by the way, I love that. Thank you for sharing that. That's been my experience, too. I almost never ask for myself.
I have had some really strange experiments. I used to be an airline pilot. You can't do drugs. You can't drink. You know, all this regular stuff. And I was at home on a couple days off and laying in my bedroom, just taking it easy. And a bubble showed up over at the door, and I got to looking at it because it was kind of strange, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm. And pretty soon it was the size of a person, and it was a lady with long black hair, probably partial Indian lady, and she was wearing a leather dress that had fringe on the bottom, and along the top of the bodice was one row of blue turquoise beads. And she said, I have a message for Kay. And Kay was one of my flight attendant friends, and we'd been friends for many years. And I said, okay. And she said, tell her everything's fine. I'm happy. And I don't hurt. I'm fine. And so she disappeared the same way. And I called up Kay, and I said, Kay, who do you know that has long black hair, who looks like she's about 18, and has this dress that's made out of leather with fringe on the bottom, and it has a row of blue beads along the bodice? And she said, well, she has white hair. And I said, well, she looked like she was about 18 years old, and she didn't have white hair here. And she said, Fred, she was killed yesterday in a car train accident.
Oh, my God.
Oh, boy.
And she was, her daughter and I were best friends, and I was raised at her house most of my life. Another interesting experience, I'll make it quick, is I happened to be over at this flight attendant's house. We were friends, no big deal. She had a common law husband who got colon cancer and died very quickly. She cared for him. And I went over to see how she was doing. And she sat down on the couch, and I sat down on a chair that was 90 degrees to the couch. And I looked over towards the credenza, and I could see like a being of light over there, a yellow, very yellow light. And as I was watching him, he kind of drifted over to her, and he leaned over, and he kissed her forehead. And I said, Kay, do you know what Dennis just did? I said, do you feel he's here? And she said, oh, yeah, I feel he's here, but I can't see him. And I said, well, he came over, and he leaned over, and he kissed you on the forehead. And she said, I felt the cold air, but I didn't know what it was.
That's perfect. And, Gary, thank you. The name of the book, The Sacred Promise, by Dr. Gary Schwartz. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.